This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up in this Radio EcoShock show, what you and your government are not being told about the threat of rising seas. Plus, how climate change was a driver in the civil war in Syria and Yemen. We finish up with a frank talk about thawing permafrost and why millions of Russians think global warming is a really good idea. More of the talk usually left unsaid right here on Radio EcoShock. Scientists on Radio EcoShock have warned that sea level rise, not heat, may be the biggest and most costly threat of climate change. We know coastal cities around the world are endangered, but are governments getting the best advice from official bodies like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change? A new report from researchers at the University of Southampton in the UK says no. Their commentary, published in the journal Nature Climate Change, says critical risks are not being well communicated. The lead author of that paper, Sea Level Rise Scenarios and Coastal Risk Management, is Professor Jochen Hinkle. He was on Radio EcoShock this past February. Here to explain the new work is co-author Robert James Nichols. He's an award-winning professor of coastal engineering at the University of Southampton. We've reached Dr. Nichols in the Maldives, an endangered island nation in the Indian Ocean. Dr. Nichols, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, well, welcome. It's good to be speaking to you.
Why are you in the Maldives?
We're in the Maldives because we're doing research with the Maldivian government, sponsored by the European Union, on climate change, particularly sea level rise impacts. And we're discussing that research with them and the results. And we're also going out in the field and collecting information and getting a feel for the Maldives in general.
I'm going to ask you a little more about that later, but I'd like to start with a quote that you have right in the beginning of your published commentary about the IPCC. You say that they, quote, aims to understand and reduce uncertainty, a viewpoint that is quite different from the one of coastal management, which aims to reduce risks. And you say that's not spelled out clearly in the IPCC reports. Could you explain the difference and why that is critically important?
The IPCC is doing a good job of actually trying to understand sea level as a phenomenon. What is the sort of possible range of sea level rise? But however, when you're thinking about adaptation, often what you're concerned about is really the high-end change of sea level rise. What might happen over a certain time period and the high end of the change. And that is not being... That is rather more difficult to actually quantify and is not really expressed in the IPCC terribly well. They're talking about what might be the middle part of the range of change. When I'm talking with stakeholders, they're really always wanting to know, well, what's the highest high-end change? What might be the worst we can see is often the main focus. You might say, adaptation is focusing often on maybe the low probability but high consequence change that might occur.
So your paper, it shows a kind of a graph that goes up and down, a nice curve, but on the right-hand end of the curve, there's kind of a fat tail of possibilities. Does the IPCC really look at that tail of extreme sea level rise, let's say?
No, I think in the AR5 they do acknowledge it exists. I would say in the AR4 they almost didn't mention it except maybe in a qualitative sense. And that really is the key point of the paper, that the IPCC ranges do not well describe that tail of risk which decision makers are particularly concerned about. When I go out and talk with some people about adaptation, we spend most of our time discussing that high-end tail, essentially, and how we can quantify it and what it means for the adaptation decision-making. And we're not spending much time discussing sort of the 50-centimeter sort of changes. People are often focusing on the one. They're talking 1 meter, 2 meter. Sometimes they're coming up with numbers that really probably could even be impossible, but in their minds they're very worried about them, so they're talking about many meters of change in the 21st century, which I think is virtually impossible.
But as you say in your paper, the IPCC results may not be 100% reliable, partly because they're based on models, and even those model results are hard to understand. It sounds like there's some things that we just don't know.
I think it's very hard to make judgments about the future, and the IPCC strongly emphasizes the process-based models, and there are other lines of evidence about what sea level might be in the future and how fast it might change. For example, there are the semi-empirical models. They correlate temperature and sea level rise. There are paleoclimatic approaches that look at the geological record and see how fast sea level has changed. And there are approaches that look at sort of physical limits. And all three of those methods suggest numbers that are above the range that the IPCC suggests. And therefore, in our paper, we feel that that information should not be discounted when we're thinking about the future and adaptation needs.
And there's another huge problem, and that's when we try to interpret these global mean sea level rises to local realities. I mean, for one example, I just want to quote this. It says, sea levels across the northeast coast of the United States rose nearly 3.9 inches between 2009 and 2010, and that's attributed not to land sinking, but to changes in ocean currents in that science. So it's not a simple equation. Doesn't a lot depend on other local conditions?
Well, global sea level, in a way, is, as you showed there, I think it's not really what we want to manage. We want to manage the local sea level that we see at a particular place, and the land can be rising or sinking, and if it's rising, that tends to offset sea level rise, and if it's sinking, it makes it worse. We do get these changes in ocean circulation. I mean, a one-year change, though, I would caution, don't worry too much about a one-year change. The question is, will it be sustained? Because we do know that the sea level goes up and goes down. Although I realize in that particular paper that you're mentioning, they do think that, based on observations again, the interesting point is that what's been seen off in the northeast of the United States is rather unusual and has not really been seen before in the observations. So I think that is important. But the key point is we want to manage local sea level, and that means the uncertainties are actually higher than they are with global mean sea level rise, because there are other factors to think about.
Well, I'm presuming that the highest global mean sea level rise prediction corresponds to the worst case IPCC scenario, which they call RCP 8.5, and that is the course we're currently on with our emissions. I wonder if you could talk to us about what such a world would look like when my 5-year-old grandchild becomes an older man.
Well, I mean, the RCP 8.5, I mean, we're going to see a significant amount of global warming. I mean, again, there's an uncertainty around the amount of global warming, but I think above 4 degrees centigrade or above warming, it could be significantly more than that. And in terms of sea level rise, that will mean a warming of the ocean and an expansion of the ocean. It'll also mean that we'll see the loss of glaciers, and also I think the likelihood in places like Greenland and Antarctica that some of that ice will also have been lost. So sea levels would be significantly higher than they are today globally, and that would translate locally with some uncertainties into higher sea levels, significantly higher sea levels virtually everywhere around the planet.
What would a full range estimate, you know, that one-third risk that you've talked about, mean for a city like London, England?
Well, I mean, London, England's a good example, because actually in London, the planning there has taken into account sort of high-end sea level rise. For London has pretty good flood defences today. The Thames Barrier means, and associated defences means, it's about a 1 in 1,000 chance of flooding today. In fact, it's lower than that. It's probably 1 in 2,000, which means flooding now today could happen, but it's very, very unlikely. And planners are thinking about raising those defences today. So if it happened in London, there'd almost certainly be a response that would mean that the risks of flooding would not actually rise. In many other cities, the risks, that planning is not in place, and so the risks of flooding in those cities would increase dramatically. And, you know, if you didn't adapt to that kind of change, you would really be talking about areas going from being safe places to live to places that were flooded very, very frequently to the point where people might have to leave. So it could be very dramatic impacts in places you don't protect. I think in London, because people are planning adaptation now, I don't think that would happen there.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Robert Nichols, an expert in coastal engineering from the University of Southampton in Britain. Well, we also have entire countries at risk in the Pacific. As you know, you are in the Maldives now. What is your reading of the situation there?
Well, the Maldives, I mean, it's, well, I've seen the islands, and none of them are really high, and sort of, I think the highest point in the country is 2.4 meters above mean sea level. So, I think in the case of the Maldives, certainly these are sea level rise really is an existential threat to the country. And the Maldives, I suppose the islands themselves won't cease to exist. There'll still be islands here, I think, with such a change. But the consequences for the people living here could be very, very profound. We're working with the Maldivian government, and one of the things that we're doing is looking at impacts and also how you might adapt to sea level rise in these settings. And the Maldivian government actually is building new land areas for people to live on. They're expanding out into the sea in places where they have a shortage of land. And one of the points, I suppose, that we're making is the need for them to think about if they're going to build land, to make it higher than they would do before to allow for sea level rise. So I think it brings out the point that those types of responses need to be done. But, you know, I think that it would mean that many islands would have to be abandoned, really, in practical terms, and that the population might concentrate on a few places where you might be able to protect them and maintain their life here in the ocean. But it would be a major, we're talking about a major challenge for the people living here. If that fails, they'll obviously be leaving.
I keep seeing maps showing abnormally hot ocean temperatures in many parts of the world, and that's where much of our heat is going. Even without ice melt, how much will thermal expansion add to rising seas?
Well, thermal expansion, we're talking about sort of tens of centimeters, really. But so sea levels will rise even if there is no melting of ice whatsoever, just due to thermal expansion. But really the big concern in terms of sea level rise is Greenland and Antarctica. And I think there lies the problem, in that our scientific understanding of the response of the large ice sheets to global warming is rather poor. And a lot of scientists are working on this, so I think that will improve over the coming decades. I think it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen in the next year. It's going to happen over decades. And that, in many ways, captures this idea of the high-risk change, that there is a huge amount of uncertainty about how these ice sheets might respond, and that's very hard to characterize.
Yes, I think we were surprised by some of the news coming out from NASA about Antarctica. We thought that it was stable and maybe even getting a bit colder in spots, but now we find out that the warmer seas are melting it from underneath. And I wonder, does the IPCC report reflect this new science about the contribution of Antarctica to rising seas?
I mean, I think the AR5 report looks at Antarctica. So I think they do discuss that as a possible source of sea level rise. But I think, again, it's back to this issue of does it really capture the high-end possible change? We mentioned London earlier on in our discussion, and in London, the planning for sea level rise assumes quite large possible changes. They were sort of thinking up to maybe 2 meters by the end of the century, not for planning purposes. Let me explain this just a little bit more, because what was done was looking at how much might sea level rise change, And we looked at the IPCC range, but as well as the IPCC range, we thought about a much larger rise, up to 2 meters for planning purposes. And what we asked people to do was to say, and what was done in London was to say, well, what happens if the sea rises 2 meters? It's a bit like your question with the Maldives a moment ago. In the case of London, we can protect against 2 meters. We can, in fact, protect against 3 or 4 meters of sea level rise. It doesn't seem to be something that's technically impossible or economically unwise because London is such a large and valuable city. And the key point is, by doing that analysis, it was called the Thames Estuary 2100 project, the planning is in place for the different types of options that might be needed, depending on how much sea level rise might be. Sea level rise might not be at the high end, but the point is, if you've thought through what you would do across the range of possible changes, you're ready for what nature will throw at you, and you also have an understanding of the decisions that you might need to take. You've already done a lot of the work, so you can make decisions much more quickly if the worst case does actually happen.
You also point out a fundamental weakness in the way the IPCC is organized. Why is the science of sea level rise in a different working group from the people working on solutions for coastal risk management?
Well, I mean, that's an historical situation, I think, which made sense when it was started in 19... The first IPCC assessment was in 1990, so we're now on to the sort of, you know, we'll be going into the sixth assessment if that goes ahead. And this structure has just been, has persisted through. And I think what we're saying in the paper is that now it might well be wise to start to try and break down some of these barriers and focus around questions that groups of people or groups of scientists answer, because these are the kinds of questions that we see coming from people interested in climate change and interested in impacts and adaptation. But one part of that is breaking down some of these barriers so that we get teams working on these, on the questions that will be asked.
What's your impression of which world governments are the most active in seeking the best sea level science, and by contrast, which countries seem slow to take this up?
Well, I think the UK and the Netherlands and Germany, to me, really are the three countries probably that are, that have taken the most kind of proactive measures on sea level rise. I've mentioned London already. The Dutch have come up with what they call the Delta Plan, which looks at the future of the Netherlands over the next 100 years, and implicitly even over the next few 100 years, well, under a changing world, including rising sea level. And they have come up with a sort of a plan and a process of adaptation that is going to be implemented over the next decades and beyond. I'd say in many other parts of the world, people are aware of sea level rise, but they're not starting this planning process. And I think we live in a world where sea levels are rising. We live in a world where even if we had climate mitigation, this is a kind of key point, sea levels would rise less if we mitigated and climate change and stopped global warming, but they wouldn't stop rising altogether. We would see, even under the lowest RCP scenario, sea levels keep on rising because the ocean has a very long time scale and takes time to respond to warming. And so the sea will rise for hundreds of years into the future, even if we stabilize climate. So therefore, I think coastal societies need to prepare for that change. And that's a process. It's not a one, you can't fix it in one go. It's something you have to do in an ongoing manner. And most countries probably haven't really engaged with that need for an adaptation process. Although they start, I mean, many are starting to. So I think, you know, it's something that takes resources, time, and commitment.
Right. Well, my second to last question here. I've just heard a speech by the seasoned oceanographer Jeremy Jackson. He told the U.S. Naval Academy that cities like Miami cannot be saved. They will simply go underwater sooner or later. Do you think he's going too far?
I'm a professor of coastal engineering, so I suppose I'm a bit more optimistic than he is. I think there are options around cities to actually protect and save them, but they cost money. And they require, and particularly, they require society to organize, I think, and work together. They require appropriate governance. And so if you don't mobilize all these different things and start planning now, then you might have big disasters. And I wouldn't expect to see a city be sort of submerged in one great event. But if a city is hit by a terrible storm, and then that causes an economic decline in the city, that could trigger, I think, a cycle of decline and maybe ultimate abandonment. So I think it's actually how sea level will manifest is quite complex, I think, and it's about an interaction between the climate change and the, if you like, the economy of a coastal region. If that economy can generate the resources to adapt, then maybe you can have a sort of virtuous cycle. If it can't, then clearly, I think you're heading into the situation of abandonment, ultimately.
As we wrap up, is there anything else that I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners?
I'd like to emphasize the point that sea level rise is a long-term phenomenon. It's going to go on for hundreds of years. That isn't mentioned in the paper, but it's an important point that doesn't seem often to be understood by people making public policy. And I think that this issue, what your children do, that your children will have to do more than you do, and your grandchildren will have to do more than they do. And I think that that's an important message for all people living on the coast, that they should expect sea levels to rise and be prepared for it. I don't think it means we need to give up, but we need to be ready for it and have plans in place so that we can deal with this when it happens.
The commentary we've been talking about was published in the journal Nature Climate Change. It is titled Sea Level Rise Scenarios and Coastal Risk Management. We've been talking with the co-author, Robert J. Nichols. He's a professor of coastal engineering at the University of Southampton in the UK. You can find links for this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Dr. Nichols, thank you for getting up so early in the morning and talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Scientists have predicted climate change could lead to instability within some nations and war. In a report released in October 2014, the U.S. Pentagon said the same thing. Now we have the first peer-reviewed study saying climate wars are not just for the future. One may have already happened in Syria. We have the lead author of that paper with us, Dr. Colin Kelly. Colin is a postdoctoral fellow with the Geography Climate Hazards Group at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Colin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
What stimulated you to take on this research into the role of climate change in the Syrian civil war?
Well, it began with some other papers that I had done earlier in my PhD when I was studying the Greater Mediterranean, but then also the Eastern Mediterranean. And what we discovered was that the Eastern Mediterranean is kind of a distinct region in that it doesn't have much influence from these low-frequency natural variability, such as what's happening over the Atlantic or the Pacific, et cetera. And what that meant for this was that it was a more clear human-induced trend in this region that was kind of emerging from the natural variability. And that's not happening in a lot of other places. So, you know, shortly after the uprising occurred in 2011 in Syria, we knew there had been a very severe drought there that had occurred. So we kind of said, well, you know, how severe, how unusual was this drought, and how was it influenced by this long-term trend in precipitation? So that's kind of how we got started.
And I also read through a paper from the 2011 study from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They found, quote, human-caused climate change is a major factor in more frequent Mediterranean droughts. How did they and your team eliminate the things you were talking about, those natural variables like the North Atlantic Oscillation? Why aren't those sufficient causes for the drier winters in those countries you studied?
What we saw for the Eastern Mediterranean was these trends that we were seeing were long-term trends. This is like 8,500-year trends. Now, the North Atlantic Oscillation, what's happening over the Atlantic, has multi-decadal variability, which means it'll go up for 30 years and go down for 30 years, et cetera. But it doesn't have the same kind of low-frequency variability that we were seeing in these trends. So that leads us to conclude that in the absence of any kind of natural variability explanation for these very long-term trends, it does match the time evolution of CO2 and what we would expect for human-induced change during that period of time.
Colin, please tell us what happened to Syrian farmers starting in 2006.
Well, when the drought hit, and it was the most severe drought in the observed record, and came shortly after two other multi-decadal droughts, one in the 80s and one in the 90s, this drought was so severe that the agriculture collapsed in the Northeast. It's referred to as the breadbasket region because they're strongly dependent on the wheat production there. Syria had actually gotten to the point that wheat production represented 25% of its gross domestic product. And then after the drought hit, the agriculture collapsed, and that GDP took a huge hit. Syria went from being a net exporter of wheat to a net importer of wheat. And basically all of these farmers, in an effort to survive, picked up their families, abandoned their villages, and went to the cities in Syria's west to try and make a living.
And you found government agriculture policy may have contributed to the problems from the drought. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. Like I said, they had a very strong emphasis on the wheat production, which had served them well for a couple of decades. But what happened was they were basically, the population was going up dramatically, you know, even since, you know, the last several decades. In the 1950s, total population of Syria was roughly 5 million, and it went up to 20 million recent years. So what you had was a reduction in precipitation, and the groundwater was steadily going down. So it was less of a supply for water and more of a demand for water. And so basically the consequences of the agricultural collapse were pretty dire.
Surely this drought is hitting parts of Turkey as well, and they have loads of refugees now from Iraq and Syria. Why don't we see more social unrest there?
Well, as we talk about a little bit in the paper, because that's a question that a lot of people ask, you know, why Syria? And the thing is that Syria had a dramatically high vulnerability at the time of the drought. Turkey and some of the surrounding areas, Iraq included, were not as dependent on their wheat production. And basically, you know, all of these countries have different governments, different economies, different levels of vulnerability and resilience. So that in this case, Syria's vulnerability was acute, and so they could not withstand the multi-year drought.
And as I understand it, Colin Kelly, your team doesn't say climate change directly caused the Syrian civil war, but acted as a catalyst. Can you explain that?
Sure. When we looked at these long-term trends and we saw that the recent drought was the most severe drought in the observed record, what we wanted to try and do was to quantify how much more severe the drought was because of the long-term trend. So we took these observations and we basically removed the long-term trend, and we determined that it was 2 to 3 times more likely that you would get a drought of this severity when you include the trend versus when you don't. And then we went to the global climate models to see if they corroborated that. And we compared experiments that had only natural variability to experiments that had the observed forcing, CO2 rise, et cetera, during the 20th century. And the models had a surprisingly consistent result with the observations, which is, you know, that it's 2 to 3 times more likely to get these severe droughts.
Can you describe for us the long-term trends that could make the Mediterranean countries and the Middle East even drier and hotter in the future?
Sure. What we saw was not only a significant downward trend in precipitation, but also an increase in the surface temperature, which basically means for the Fertile Crescent, which gets all of its rainfall in a six-month period, November through April, but gets all of its evaporation during what you can think of as the six-month summer. So this is serving to dry out the soil, essentially, and reduce the soil moisture. And then in winter, it acts as a double whammy because it's reduced precipitation. So both of these things are acting together to strongly dry this region. In addition, the atmospheric sea level pressure has been steadily rising. And what that does is it changes the circulation. It alters where the winds are coming from and affects the moisture that typically comes in from the Mediterranean Sea.
Is the Mediterranean Sea warming?
From what I've seen, yeah, the Mediterranean Sea is warming and increasing in its evaporation, which means it's become increasingly salty as well.
Have you had any contact with Syria or feedback regarding your study?
You know, that's a good question, because I think it was yesterday or the day before yesterday, I got an email from a scientist who is, I believe, I can't remember which university, but basically he said that he is a Syrian national, and he was actually in Syria when the drought hit, and he was at a conference, and he and some other scientists were telling the Syrian government, basically, that, you know, this was a big problem, this drought, and that the resilience to this drought was not, you know, what it needed to be. And then at the end of the drought, obviously, when this chain of events occurred and the uprising happened. So he said that he was not at all surprised by this, that it had been predicted to a certain degree by these other scientists at the time. And so he agreed with the study, which was a nice confirmation.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Colin Kelly at the University of California Climate Hazards Group. Another party that ends up with this end of the stick is the United Nations and the various charities trying to feed millions of refugees from the Syrian civil war and I guess from the drought as well. What do they say about the impact of climate change in the region?
Well, I would say, yeah, you're certainly right. I mean, you know, the United Nations and the Red Cross, and certainly they have limited resources. And so in this region in particular, it's, you know, with the ongoing conflict and et cetera, it makes it increasingly difficult for them to have their humanitarian aid. One of the other countries that I started working on recently is Yemen. And Yemen is a country that has rampant famine. It's one of the most famine-prone countries in the world. And it was also one of the Arab Spring uprising countries. And the government has recently collapsed or deposed there. So there are a lot of similarities to be drawn between Yemen and Syria, even though there are some differences in the rainfall, et cetera.
I'm glad you raised that, because I was wondering if your work could be expanded to some of the other revolutions in North Africa. I'm thinking of Egypt and even more the continuing civil war in Libya. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, we have taken a brief look at some of those countries, some of the other Arab Spring countries. But one of the things that we're really looking for is to see whether there's any kind of a trend before the violence erupted. Now, there are a lot of reasons, even in the Syrian case, why an uprising can occur. And a lot of times it's just a question of how all of these factors come together to produce that. In some of these other countries, it looks like there was less of a climate change influence. And so it was the other factors that were more important in the conflicts erupting in these other countries. But there's still a lot of research to be done on that.
And I've seen maps of projections for the impact of climate change in a longer range, perhaps hundreds of years, and they show a huge desert linking up across the subtropics, including North Africa and the Middle East, but extending into China and maybe even parts of North and South America. Have we already started on that process?
It appears so. I mean, a lot of the predictions by the global climate model for the 21st century, globally, essentially, is that wet places are expected to get wetter and dry places are expected to get drier, which is bad news for arid and semi-arid countries already that are strained for resources, because if we continue on this trajectory that we're on now, and we've already started to see evidence of these kinds of things, then it will only continue to get worse during the century.
Another party that's interested in this, of course, is the military. They have done a report, the Pentagon has, about climate change being a threat multiplier. Have you heard from them at all?
I haven't heard from them, but I've seen a lot of the quotes by them. And you know, there's some other strong statements to go along with it, but I think a threat multiplier is a great way to characterize it, because as we characterize it in our paper, it's not saying that climate change is going to cause a lot of these things, but rather that it's going to be a significant contributing factor. So you have to consider all the factors, but certainly climate change is going to act to make these situations worse.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners, perhaps something I've missed about your research and this paper?
I don't think so. It's just like you said before, I wanted to stress that what we're saying is that climate change is just a piece to this puzzle. In this case, it served to exacerbate what was already a natural multi-year drought, making it the worst drought, and this set about a catalytic chain of events, you know, the agricultural collapse and the mass migration and this huge increase in population in urban areas all before the uprising.
We've been talking about the role of climate change in the Syrian civil war. The paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy, or PNAS, is titled Climate Change in the Fertile Crescent and Implications of the Recent Syrian Drought. You can find links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Our guest is Dr. Colin Kelly from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Colin, you've had huge media coverage of this paper. Thank you for finding time to talk with us on Radio EcoShock.
Certainly, my pleasure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We don't very often hear about what is happening in Russia, especially now with the latest freeze in relations. So I'm happy to bring you this next interview about how the Russian North is thawing and what that means for their economy and the people who live there. Will disappearing permafrost change the future for the whole world? You bet it will. We live on a strange planet. Few people realize that almost a quarter of the land in the northern half of this world is frozen. Under a thin layer that thaws under the summer sun, the land is always frozen underneath. It's called permafrost. It extends from Alaska, across northern Canada, Scandinavia, and finds another giant kingdom in the Russian north, in Siberia. The small population of the permafrost lands have become accustomed to it. They adapted to a solid icy foundation. In fact, they depend on it. New science confirms the world's permafrost has been slowly thawing. Now, with climate change, that pace has quickened. Here to explain what that means for society and for the economy of Russia in particular is Nikolay Shilomanov. Nikolay is an associate professor in the Department of Geography at George Washington University, and he's an Arctic researcher. Nikolay Shilomanov, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
All right. Thank you, Alex.
So, new research about permafrost was published this month in the journal Nature Geoscience. It's by a team of Russian and German experts. Yes, despite the Cold War, the scientific cooperation goes on, and that's a good thing that it does. Now, for people who have never seen it, Nikolay, what is permafrost?
Well, permafrost, there is nothing spectacular about it. It's just cold dirt. Essentially, I mean, by scientific definition, this is just ground which remains at temperature below 0 degrees C or 32 degrees Fahrenheit for two or more years. So, again, it can be just a pretty cold rock, I mean, somewhere in Alps or in our Rocky Mountains, or it can be some, you know, significant ice found somewhere in Siberia or Canada or Alaska. So, but again, basically it's just a cold dirt. I mean, that's pretty much it.
And so what would permafrost look like for those of us standing above it on the ground, and what does it look like to scientists who investigate it?
Well, it depends on where you are, and actually it depends on how much ice is embedded within that cold dirt. I mean, for example, in some areas, you know, in Alaska, in northern Alaska, or, you know, in Siberia or in Canada, in tundra environments, you might kind of onboard your plane and the environment will look just like Kansas. I mean, just, you know, flat, grassy plains. You know, and there will be very little to indicate that there is a frozen ground underneath. On the other hand, we might have a spectacular, you know, almost volcano-look mountains, which core of them are completely frozen or, you know, solid ice. And, you know, anything in between, all sorts of topography.
Previous research, Nikolay, used living materials like pollen or tree rings to study the Arctic past. How did this group from the Alfred Wegener Institute manage to measure time and temperature in land ice?
This is really interesting, and this is probably the biggest contribution of that paper. That, I mean, they were able to use what we called ice wedges. So those, I mean, the big volumes of ice formed in, you know, thermal cracks on the ground. So basically the ground just cracks. I mean, similar to our, you know, pavements, for example, when it undergoes significant contractions during the cold period and expansion during the warm period. And that happening, you know, all over the Arctic. And then the meltwater, predominantly from the snow in the spring, just filled the gap, extends the crack by kind of, obviously by 9%, weather expands by 9% during the freezing. And then the next year, a little bit more meltwater can get in. So essentially, over 500 years, those cracks can be filled with pretty massive amount of ice. And that ice will have that very characteristic vertical structure corresponding to annual accumulation of snow melt water. And as a result, that can be pretty easily to distinguish how many layers and how many, you know, how many years passed by. And then the people, I mean, in Alfred Wegener Institute, were, you know, taking all those layers and studying their isotope composition. So, again, very similar to Greenland ice or Antarctic ice, I mean, which is used for paleoclimate research. But the difference here is the majority of that ice is formed from snowmelt water, and as a result, it represents a winter condition. So, and if you study the isotopic composition, the lighter the isotopes, the warmer the period when that, you know, ice was formed. And then they were able to reconstruct it. And what makes it really interesting and differ from other Arctic paleo reconstructions is the majority of Arctic paleo work was based on the living things, such as pollen or tree rings, and they more correspond to, you know, to warmer seasons. And that ice corresponds kind of serves as an additional piece in the puzzle, giving us the history of temperature over the colder periods, over the winter.
Yes, I found it interesting in looking at the science that scientists have thought that the summers in the Arctic might have been getting colder, but the winters might have been getting warmer, and this research seems to confirm that. Now, you raised the issue of melting glaciers in places like Greenland. That's received a lot of press, and yet we hardly hear about permafrost. How would you compare the importance of thawing permafrost to things like the glaciers in Greenland?
Well, obviously, the glaciers are extremely spectacular features. I mean, they are cool to look at. I mean, again, permafrost is just a frozen dirt which can be pretty deep underground. So in terms of media coverage, I would go and study Greenland because it's simply more spectacular. And actually, it's more fascinating for the public, for the general public, if you wish. In terms of significance, I would say that ice is obviously the Greenlandic ice or, you know, Antarctic or glacial ice in general. It's exposed to the elements, right? So it's just right in the interface between the surface and the atmosphere. And as a result, it's the effect of climatic changes are probably more immediate in relations, immediate for glaciers than for something buried under sometimes significant depths, into the ground.
So what would be the benefits of a warming climate for Siberia and Siberians?
Well, the benefits is pretty obvious. I mean, the Russia in general, it's a cold country. I mean, a little bit of warmth, you know, will not hurt anybody. And that counts for agricultural production. If you have a little bit more CO2 in the air and the warmer climate, then kind of bring it on. I mean, the plants like it, especially in risky, agriculturally risky environments like, you know, most of Russia. The other obvious benefit is the decrease in heating demand, because in Russia, for, you know, every product you are making, I mean, the majority, of course, going into the heating of the, I mean, and the, you know, obviously the structures should be a little bit, you know, better build your factories and, you know, things like that.
So there are also, though, a host of difficult challenges when the subsurface ground thaws. For example, what happens to infrastructure like the roads?
Again, it's quite obvious. I mean, in Russia, people very well accustomed to living in permafrost. And I'm not talking about just indigenous communities who obviously been living in those environments for thousands of years, but I mean the kind of industrialized, you know, society. For example, I mean, right now in Russia, more than 5% of Russian population lives in permafrost. And if, what is Russian population is roughly 140, 145 million, that will come to 7 to 8 million people. And majority of those people are living in urbanized environments, so living in cities, which is totally different from, let's say, North American continent, you know, Canada and Alaska, for example. And when the permafrost is stable, there were lots of engineering solutions developed to how to build enormous structures on permafrost. The problem is that right now, as climate is changing, obviously permafrost is a product of cold climate, and as climate is getting a little bit warmer, the permafrost begins to warm up and, you know, degrade in some places. And if you have, you know, structures or roads or pipelines or railroads built on permafrost, that might cause a significant challenge. And the challenge predominantly from the presence of ground ice underneath. As the ground gets warmer, the ice might melt, the water runs off, and that might create a pretty substantial subsidence of the surface. If you have something built on that surface, obviously that can cause significant structural deformations.
I've heard of buildings starting to tip and even whole forests starting to fall over. They call them drunken forests.
Yes, I mean, it's been happening on and off forever. So part of it is a natural process. I mean, in some places, even right now, permafrost is upgrading or even forming. In some places, it's thawing slightly or degrading. And, you know, part of that is not induced by climate. There's just kind of a natural cycle of things. And the drunken forest you are referring to is, you know, it's been happening for quite a long time in many places. It's not exactly part of ongoing climatic trend, but obviously changing climate doesn't help things.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about how the top of the world land base is thawing out slowly. Nikolay Shilimanov, can you talk to us about the possible impacts of melting permafrost on Russia's oil and gas industry?
Well, again, it obviously the oil and gas worries about it, big oil and big gas worries about that. Pretty significant Russian reserves are located in permafrost regions. Even right now, you know, 93% of natural gas, Russian natural gas, and 75% of oil are produced in permafrost areas. And by the way, that accounts for a quarter of global gas productions and almost 11% of global oil production. I mean, there are pretty significant challenges, and that majority of them relates to linear infrastructure, namely pipelines. Right, because, I mean, the pipelines traverse, you know, Siberia, you know, left and right, and they go through pretty heterogeneous terrain with variable permafrost conditions and with variable rate of thawing, and in some places even aggregation or development of permafrost. It makes it extremely hard to make them stable. There are some reports, at least anecdotal reports. I mean, I couldn't find the official statistics that the number of ruptures or accidents on pipelines have been increased dramatically. Again, we always need to be careful if this can be attributed directly to climatic change or some anthropogenic factors like neglect, lack of maintenance, and, you know, things of that nature. But obviously, you know, changing in the climate-induced permafrost conditions are not helping. So in general, when permafrost is stable, people know how to deal with it. I mean, especially in Russia, they have a very long experience on building massive engineering structures like Trans-Siberian Railroad, for example, on permafrost. But the problem is not permafrost itself, but the changing permafrost conditions.
Even with those problems, though, it would be only human for people in very cold places to quietly welcome a warmer climate. Do you think some Russians in the north feel that way about global warming?
Well, in Russia in general, I mean, the people welcome global warming. I mean, again, it's a northern country. I mean, it will help industry. It will help, I mean, agricultural production. And again, this, with the climate like in Russia, I mean, a little bit of warmth never hurt. And again, plus CO2, a little bit of CO2, good for agriculture too, especially in risky, you know, in risky areas. However, there are pretty interesting challenges. There were quite recently, the Security Council of Russian Federation was discussing the security threats posed by climate change to Russia. And it's interesting that half of that report states that climate change is good for Russia, for, you know, majority of things. And the negative impacts they list, number one is, you know, warming and thawing of permafrost, with all those infrastructure problems which might relate to that. And the other threat is geopolitical, because obviously the Russia will probably benefit from the climate change, but its neighbors, especially down south in Central Asia, are already suffering enormously. And the Russia really worries about enhanced, you know, legal and illegal migration and all those geopolitical tensions related to that.
On another topic, a community of scientists and concerned citizens are closely watching satellite measurements of methane coming from the Arctic. There have been some high readings. Are you concerned about methane coming from ancient vegetation now melting along with the permafrost?
Well, to tell you the truth, I never studied that area, but I watch it closely. And to me, it looks like the jury is still out there. I mean, there were several kind of really alarming scenarios, and people were referring to methane bombs and, you know, things of that nature. But more detailed studies are needed to see what is the global significance of that organic carbon release into the atmosphere. And again, that's kind of a, there are several papers which are totally contradict to each other, and there are several scientific groups. One say that that will be pretty significant, and others say that this is probably not quite so.
Do you know, Nicolay, if the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change accounts for melting permafrost in their predictions of greenhouse gases and warming?
Well, I mean, first of all, Alex, again, you just kind of permafrost soaks. It doesn't melt, right? So ice melts, permafrost soaks. There are several models. I mean, for example, the NCAR, National Climate, National Center for Atmospheric Prediction, this is the U.S. model. There are some attempts to account for, you know, for permafrost degradation and warming, but as far as I know, very few models, and predominantly regional models, not the global circulation models, or general circulation models operating on a global scale, account for permafrost. And actually none of them accounting for that organic carbon release into the atmosphere.
Not yet.
No. I mean, obviously, the groups are working on it, but if you look at the latest IPCC report and the models which were participating in the climate model intercomparison project prior to the report, you know, none of them is accounting for the release of carbon from permafrost.
Well, it took them a while to catch up to the ice measurements as well, because they just didn't have the science yet, and I think permafrost may be like that. Do you think that scientists and world governments are paying enough attention to this Arctic land instead of watching things like rapidly melting sea ice?
Sure. No, it's interesting. I've been and was studying it for 20 years, and it's amazing, I mean, from my graduate work, and it's amazing to see how in mid-90s even, I mean, the permafrost was totally on the fringes of kind of a main global change research, which was developing, obviously, at the time, and how now it's getting a more, you know, central stage, right? So there is enormous interest in permafrost. So we are getting there, but not quite there yet.
Nicolay, what are your personal further interests in research in the Arctic?
Well, there are several approaches we are taking here at GW. I mean, the first one is obvious. I mean, it's a permafrost observation. We are managing and one of the, you know, global networks on state of permafrost, and we are predominantly concerned with that upper layer, which kind of thaws and freezes in the annual basis, and we have more than 200 sites, you know, distributed in the northern hemisphere, and we have participants from Canada, obviously, Russia, and, you know, Scandinavian countries, trying to use standardized methodology and to go and measure it every year to see what the changes are and how they can be related to changes in climatic conditions. And, you know, the other area, developing area of our research is the urban systems on permafrost, predominantly in Russia. Unlike, you know, North America, where predominantly indigenous populations is scattered among kind of a isolated small communities. By the way, there are just, 130,000, 150,000 people living in Canadian permafrost versus 7 million versus on Russian permafrost. And in Russia, I mean, there is a big industrial complexes and cities with, you know, 200,000, 300,000 population, completely isolated, living in Siberia. Obviously, that's not the ideal development pattern, but that was inherited by Russia from Soviet times, you know, obviously. But now what to do with those communities and how they're, you know, coping in a new market economy with changing climate and changing permafrost conditions, that's what we are trying to look at.
Are there things that society can do in Siberia, for example, to prepare and adapt for thawing permafrost?
Well, that's a difficult question. Obviously, when you are dealing with the, you know, with the smaller indigenous communities in Canada, in Alaska, for example, I mean, it's not that difficult. I mean, again, if you you know, if you have a, you know, small structures, it's not a problem to resettle. It's not, well, obviously it's a problem for individual families, but it's not as high a problem as moving 250,000 people city with enormous apartment blocks and roads and the whole supporting centralized heating and the whole supporting infrastructure. But in Russia, it's really hard to distinguish the effect of climatic change versus all those socioeconomic transitions the country went through during the 90s and in the early 2000s. For example, back during the Soviet days, in all those cities, there was centralized government monitoring, you know, programs. So essentially every city has its own permafrost monitoring programs, and they were watching it pretty closely. And if it begins to thaw by, you know, different either climatic reasons or anthropogenic reasons, I mean, they would go and mitigate it immediately why the problem is not become any bigger. But, you know, nowadays all that systems, I mean, in the 90s were completely dismantled. Everything got privatized, and actually people are in many communities left to deal with that problem on their own, and I'm not sure that they're capable of doing it. So basically, it needs to be a little bit more government involvement in those issues.
As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to talk to us about?
Well, I can talk for hours. I mean, just give me a clue.
Well, you know, I think most of our listeners at this point will be asking themselves, should I be worried about this problem or not? Is it so slow we don't have to think about it, or is it getting quicker and it really will matter?
Well, it obviously matters for people who are living on permafrost. I mean, there is no question about it. And it's obviously all those problems are front and center in Russia and in Canada and in Alaska. I mean, for example, there were several Alaskan state reports which indicate the enormous cost to infrastructure and to well-being of the Alaskan residents due to climate change in general and permafrost warming and thawing in particular. Unfortunately, I mean, in the United States, I mean, obviously, the United States is an Arctic country. It's very well represented on the Arctic Council, and actually, it's leading the Arctic Council, you know, right now. But since majority of population living below 48 degrees of latitude, it's not as solidly ingrained in American psyche that Arctic is important in general, let alone permafrost. But the things are quite different in Canada and in Russia, where people were living on permafrost for quite some time. You know, I think that this is a big problem for Alaska. In terms of its global significance, the jury is still out there. We are going to have permafrost. I mean, you know, in some areas, permafrost is longer than, older than a million years, and it survived some more significant climatic changes than what we are having right now. During, for example, during the last interglacial, there was a little bit warmer than today. But in some areas, obviously, if we are permafrost undergoes significant changes right now, and that might have pretty significant impacts for population living on it. And its global significance is still probably underestimated, especially its effect on a hydrological system, river discharges, as well as the carbon influx into the atmosphere, which we have discussed. So more studies needs to be done.
We've been talking about the almost hidden problem of thawing permafrost with Nikolay Shelemanov. He's an associate professor in the Department of Geography at George Washington University, and he's an Arctic researcher. The new paper we talked about is titled Long-Term Winter Warming Trend in the Siberian Arctic During the Mid to Late Holocene. Nikolay, thank you so much for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to follow up on our show blog every Wednesday at ecoshock.info.